Caromcast.
Welcome to the Caromcast, episode 20, broadcasting from Chemical Light Factory Studios, our brand new sprawling facility in the heart of Hollywood, California. I've got special guests with me tonight, Amy Lynn Chadwick.
Hey.
And of course, Truffle Jones.
Hello, my friends.
Who you may remember from episode 4, I believe it was, when we did our week of shows.
It's a long time ago.
What do you guys think of the new facility? Do you like the fountain?
You know, the problem with the fountain is that we had to turn it off to do this episode because of the babbling waters.
Yeah, it's so celestial.
I love the way that the water, though, it runs around the whole studio. It's like a moat.
You did that for energy reasons, right? Like a chi type of... It wasn't to keep people out.
Well, it's both chi, and it's also the fact that we use that to actually power the facility.
Oh, it's all water-based.
Yeah.
Oh, that's incredible.
Very green.
I thought it was just to get the energy of podcasting up, to lift the spirits of the people. Through the magic of the internet.
I enjoyed the butler at the door that handed me a beverage.
The people of Egypt are not enjoying the magic of the internet presently.
No, they certainly are not. They're enjoying a different kind of magic. And by magic, I mean absolute
mayhem.
Mayhem, potential obliteration, being restrained and brutalized and having any kind of moral indecency that could be proposed imposed upon them.
Yeah, it's been a week of internet control freakishness. I've got a thing on Slashdot yesterday. They were talking about the U.S. deciding to discuss the possibility of an internet kill switch again. I don't remember the first time that this was discussed because, of course, the entire purpose of the internet is to not have a kill switch, to have a central on and off switch. Because, of course, a kill switch in the hands of the TSA is a kill switch in the hands of any spy who wants to come in and shut it down before coming in and taking over the country anyway.
And any 11-year-old hacker in Romania also.
Absolutely.
So it's really a Pandora's box is what you're saying.
But the most insidious of all these internet kill switches / bottlenecks is going on up in Canada where... What was the first thing I ever told you about Canada, Amy?
Rogers is a monopoly.
Right. So now, a few years later, Rogers and Bell up in Canada have managed to get the CRTC to give them permission to meter internet usage. And I was up in Toronto, and I remember getting this notice on my browser that said, "Hello, you have used 75% of your monthly quota. Would you like to continue receiving this message?"
Hello, you are part of AOL and still on dial-up.
Which is hysterical, because when I play video on demand on Rogers up in Toronto, they can barely give us enough bandwidth to buffer their own movies. They've cinched it off so hard, and now they're charging a premium on top of that, as if bandwidth is like completely going out of style.
It's rare.
Crossing the border.
Bandwidth is really rare. I don't know if you know, they have to break off pieces of exotic asteroids and mine them and send them back to our planet in order to create bandwidth. And that's why it should cost more every day. Even here in Los Angeles, internet that was $30 last year, as of this year, is $33.13.
That's right.
It's more expensive. It's
because
just harder.
What happens is technology gets slower. It gets more difficult to build, and of course, therefore, it becomes more expensive.
Yeah, that's exactly what happens with technology. I mean, from the time we had the first wheel, which was created out of stone, I mean, that was the R&D cost alone on that thing. I mean, we're talking epic billions.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And today, if you want to go down to the store and buy a wheel, it's so much less expensive. I mean, I just got new tires for my car. I think each one was about $240.
Yeah.
Progress. Progress, baby.
Progress. So this is what I always say I'll never say on a podcast, but it has been a good long while since we've done one of these. And so
a good hot minute.
You may be listening to all of our episodes in series in one sitting, having a Caromcast marathon at home. But
not
so
in
you
Egypt,
know,
though.
Between the last of these and this one, it's been about, good God, has it been about a year?
Probably.
Just so much has that. Happened. I remember that 2010, for whatever reason, and I don't think I'm sort of putting myself in the center of the universe here, was a really, really tough year for everybody. It just seemed like everyone's nose was at the grindstone and we're not getting the results that they wanted. And it was just exhausting. full of tribulation. I just felt like everyone got smacked in the face by it.
You know who didn't have a tough 2010?
Tell me.
Investment bankers.
Hedge fund managers.
Hedge fund managers. People who made, what was it we were talking about? $5 billion last year.
And the cast of Jersey Shore did pretty well.
Yeah, that
and
one
so
hedge
did tanning
fund guy.
Booths as right. a result. Mm-hmm. So tanning booths are probably rocking in business.
Yeah.
Anyone who works for Goldman Sachs did very well.
Yeah.
But everybody else, yeah, it seems like actual real people who exist that you can meet walking down the street, not going by in a Rolls Royce limousine, those people all seem to have problems in 2010.
Ergo, 2010 could be defined as the year that there was the abolition of the middle class.
Increasingly so. I don't know if it's abolished yet, but man, it's on the way.
Yeah. I'm glad that year's over.
Yeah.
It was productive, but
I thought it was productive and full of transition. And
it was a test for to find out who the Warriors were, I felt like, anyways. Yeah. I don't know if that's too emo, but...
Well, I'm happy to see that we all came out swinging hard.
Yeah.
Well, you had enough money to get this new facility, so it couldn't have been the worst year for you.
Actually, it wasn't that I had a spectacular year in terms of income, but this was actually built by donations that came in from our listeners.
Investors and donations. Yeah. Did you have a pledge fund drive for that?
No, we didn't. People just volunteered. They just kind of threw money at us.
You might want to think about doing a pledge drive.
Although I should say that about 98% of the money did come in from Abu Dhabi. So.
Is that right?
Yeah.
It was big in the Middle East.
One big check, and then a couple of other people gave like $7 on
PayPal.
And
then Janessica, she hoarded herself out a couple times.
Oh, yeah.
Just for the show.
Yeah.
So you think 2011, by comparison, is going to be a better year than 2010?
I don't think it's going to be.
It's behind us, and 2011 is going to be, here we all are celebrating in the early part of the year. We're optimistic. We're not Egyptian, so things are looking up.
Well, I think things are looking up for the Egyptians. I mean, I think that the fact that the people really finally are kind of waking up, not just waking up, but crossing those lines is pretty spectacular and unprecedented, at least in our lifetime. I mean, seeing something like that happen is a big deal. I'm not going to put it on par with the Berlin Wall, but I mean, it's not something that anyone would have expected.
The difference, I think, is that David Hasselhoff, as we know, is directly responsible for what happened in Berlin, and it had no involvement in Egypt.
Right.
And I think had he been able to lend his passion and guidance to what's going on in Egypt, it'd be a whole different story.
But be more structured?
It'd be more structured. There'd be a lot more musical influence in terms of probably choreography and...
Flash mobs.
Well, look, I'm interested to see how this pans out, and I don't want to make too light of it because I think that, you know, already a lot of lives have been lost. I mean, not a lot, but we're talking about 20 people have died or so. And today I was getting tweets in from someone who is tweeting from Egypt. They have found ways of getting around this blackout, and they were saying that the soldiers were not turning on the people, that they were saying, we'll stand by the people, we won't turn on you. And, you know, that's kind of so that people are really encouraged by this, and it seems like there's this sort of solidarity going on, which is really quite crazy. But you don't know how these things could turn out. You know, this could get really gnarly really fast, and I don't want to be the guy who was saying moments before devastation happens that everything's going to be cool.
Of course not. And in all seriousness, no one's making light of the situation to make light of the situation. What you just brought up leads me to ask something. I'm very curious about this. How do you know somebody is sending tweets from there, and how is that vetted? I mean, how do you know it's not, again, some 11-year-old kid in Romania saying, oh, I got a workaround, and I'm sending tweets from Egypt, and this is what's going on? How do you actually know that's true? I mean, how do we not know that it's propaganda?
Sure.
Or just somebody who's having fun?
You're absolutely right.
Or what do we really take away from that, knowing that the blackout is in effect?
GPS location?
Yeah, there is that.
Do you have any way of vetting the source? Has
anybody
vetted the source?
Yeah, you can. There are geolocated tweets and so on.
Yeah.
There was an article today that did say that was discussing how people are managing to use older methods to regain access to the grid.
They're using hard lines like in the Matrix.
They're using 2,400 baud modems that are going through. There's always a way. I mean, that's the thing about the internet. I'm just sort of sure commercial ISPs were shut down, but there's always going to be a way to get back on.
And doesn't that actually kind of lead back to what you were saying before, that you're talking about the on-off switch for the internet? There actually could never be an on-off switch for the internet, because
unless they really, really blew the design, the whole purpose of the internet is that it cannot be centralized.
Right.
However,
there is no
there's a very troubling thing going on here, which is that now that everybody has furnished their home addresses and all of their relationships and their facial recognition of all of their network of friends and every other, you know, security protection information that they've surrendered, it's a known fact that Facebook, which doesn't need you to be signed on to their site to collect information about you and your pathways and your trajectories throughout the online beingness, have aggregated all of this information. And now that we are all identified, now the seal starts to tighten, you know? And now they're suddenly saying, well, we're gonna let you have this much freedom, but you've got to pay this much. This is what is extremely troubling about what's going on up in Canada. The fact that the CRTC, which is a government body, is basically bowing to these major telecom companies and saying, yeah, yeah, sure, you can meter this stuff, is going to put that country in the Stone Age.
To that
commercially
point,
and in every other way.
To that point, let's recontextualize what you just said. Stepping back and taking a dose of paranoia for a second. Given how big Google is, given how big Facebook is, and I'm sure both of those entities operate with the utmost altruism, it's almost impossible to believe that the powers that be, whoever they are, whatever they might be, would actually endorse or want to have some kind of on-off switch for the internet in Egypt and Canada, the United States, wherever, because that is their best way of keeping tabs on all of us.
Yeah.
I mean, if you have an Xbox, if you have a Kinect,
oh,
you actually have, and correct me if I'm wrong here, you have in your house a full 3D camera that can be accessed from outside.
Right. Just to explain about the Kinect, which is a new toy device that you can buy for your Xbox. It's got two cameras and it's got an IR sensor in it, which can gauge depth forward and back.
Like a robot.
So it's designed to allow you to have hands-free control and interaction with games and so on. And it did occur to me, and we had a conversation about this, that Microsoft has figured out a way to put eyeballs inside of every person's living room in the country, which they could, and they have admitted this, they could, if they wanted to do so, flip on and look through, because of course it's piping the information back to the servers. They said, of course, we would never do that. Awesome.
And if you have a Kinect, again, because obviously the rest of the world is not there for the benefit of our previous conversation, if it's on, whether or not you're using it, just happens to be on, and you stroll by.
Oh,
you,
yes.
And you have, do you want to explain that? Because
I discovered this the other day. I wasn't playing Kinect, and I had on a bathrobe, a hat, I was cold, and I just walked by really quick, and it recognized me, and it signed me into my account. Just by walking by and 3D just scanned my body, maybe the way I walk, maybe...
No, it recognizes your... Actually, the latest patch in Kinect has facial recognition. So, and it encourages you to use it in the day, in the evening, light, dark, because that way it can get a better profile of you. And it's so fun because you can just stand in front of it and you don't have to press any buttons. I'm absolutely amazed that we're inoculated against realizing just how unbelievably invasive that is.
Yeah.
But it's fun. There are benefits. And that's sort of the argument that anybody will make about Facebook or anything. They'll say, yeah, they might know all of this about me, but, you know, it really does enhance the experience, because
sure,
then I can just go on and it's a one-to-one experience. I want to segue here out of this sort of paranoia, TSA, Patriot Act nonsense for a minute and get into the fact that someone asked today, we asked people to give us questions about this podcast on Facebook, of all places, that forum for erudition. And someone said...
Face what?
It's this thing. Anyway, so they said...
is it like The Secret?
Our page got like 5,000 fans in the last month. Do you think social media is a new way of marketing? Yes.
I think it's an old way of marketing. I would say if you really step back from Facebook... And you step back from MySpace and Friendster as a predecessor and anything else, and just kind of boil it down to the basics. And this is kind of important for anybody who's listening. All it really is database marketing. You can call it your network, your circle of friends, your work contacts, your whatever, but really it's a database of contacts. It's no different in 2011 than having a day runner was in 1982. And what you're doing when you're sending out messages and writing on people's walls and everything is your marketing to your database, either a direct mail message to someone or a blast message to everybody.
Yeah, and really what you're doing is you're preaching to the choir. But what's really happening is that Facebook is understanding where the networks are and who the connectors are, and they're really the ones that are benefiting ultimately from this.
Yeah, I mean, it's everybody, I think, looks at Facebook as such, and it's incredibly culturally significant because of ease of use and because of convenience and because of the technology allows us to do things mobily now and so forth. But it's not a whole lot different from, you know, anything that's been going on in the last 100 years.
Yeah.
It just makes it that much easier.
For someone to
ask that question and not realize the answer is kind of disconcerting.
Right. Well, what I would say is that if you really do want to understand contemporary marketing strategies, it goes back to what I'm saying about facial recognition and the user-enhanced experience where it's a one-to-one relationship. It's a one-to-one relationship. You can't, if you're interested or fascinated by the fact that you have 5,000 followers to your page in a month, you're missing the point completely, because 5,000 people who happen to click a like button are not people who are going to act. They're not going to turn into conversions. It's just the same as having a billboard on a freeway and hoping that, you know, one out of 500 people. But it's really about one-to-one marketing. Like, I respond to people on a one-to-one level. Not all of them, but some of them. And I make sure I find out, who are you? What are you up to? Like, what do you like about what I do? And what are you into? And what are you doing? And where can I hear your stuff? And those people will stick around for 5 or 10 years. And those people will bring family in and whatever, but it's a real relationship. That's what contemporary marketing really is about. It's an actual legitimate interest in a one-to-one person relationship.
I think that's what contemporary marketing wants to be about and is striving to be about. And if you take a look at two models, let's look at Amazon for a second. Amazon is an interface whereby the more you use it, the smarter it gets, right? It figures out over time from what you're looking at, from what you're purchasing, from what you're sending to friends and relatives or whoever, what other things to put in front of you and how to cater to you and those interests. If you only go on Amazon one time, it doesn't know who you are. Maybe you buy something the next time you come back, or in the interim, it might send you an email. That's what you're talking about. The best way to satisfy anyone, whether it's your parents, your kids, your boyfriend, your girlfriend, your group of friends, or clients, business clients, students, whatever, is to have a profound understanding of what motivates them to act or not act, as the case may be. If you look at something more antiquated, everyone who's listening to this podcast probably once a month at least receives a circular in the mail, which is just full of coupons for car washes and dog washes and tanning, which unless you're on the Jersey Shore show, you're probably not going to use. You're probably just going to throw all that stuff right into the garbage. And the reason why is because it's not a one-to-one message, it's a broadcast message. And because they don't know who you are and what you're interested in, the onus is on you to look through all of those things and find one or four or five that actually might interest you. And then you got to clip them and use them. And once you use them, they don't really know who used them. They don't have any way of taking that information and refining it. So when you get the circular next month, it's more intelligent and more pointed toward your particular interest.
But that's
and
such a slow and sort of shooting in the dark method. So the new iteration of this is the evolution is what's going to be called O2O, a big buzzword in this next wave is going to be online to offline, and that's the stuff that we know as Groupon. And what are some of those other ones that do that? There's Groupon, and there's I Like Something, and
there's
Deals That Matter. Anyways, what an O2O is what they basically go to these local companies and they say, okay, if you offer a 50% discount on your restaurant meal entrees, we will get you 500 people to buy in. And when those 500 people buy in, everybody gets the deal. But if 500 people don't buy in, then nobody gets the deal. So it creates this time lock. It's a 24-hour time lock. It creates huge volume. It creates new awareness for the business, and everybody makes out like bandits. It's actually a brilliant, brilliant strategy. Interestingly enough, there is no O2O company, even as big as Groupon, who's spent huge, huge amounts of money, where they're like first position on every single Google AdSense position across the web, that has gone public. So when Groupon goes public, everybody go and buy some stocks in it, because it's going to be a good, it's going to be a good investment right at the outset.
I'm interested to see what actually happens with Groupon. I mean, sites that are doing, basically using that model have been around for a while now, and it's, I mean, there are way too many to name, but Woot comes to mind, or Whiskey Militia, or sites like that. But with Groupon, here's the thing. If I'm a business owner, let's say I own a restaurant, and I do an offer through Groupon, and, you know, I get the traffic. Like, we get 500 people that come in, and, you know, they're buying something for half off or some kind of discount. And so while I'm not making full revenue, I'm making it up through volume, et cetera. But curious to see, in 18 or 24 months' time, how many of these people actually return? In other words, how many people are coming in for the offer, using the offer, and then never coming back to my business again? And then a year and a half from now, I go, okay, well, that Groupon thing didn't really work out for my business.
It doesn't really matter, because they're going to still be exposed to the place, to the location, to what parking is like and everything, and they're going to mention it to somebody.
I think that's what I like about Open Table, something like that. You're exposed to restaurants and things that maybe you didn't know about in your area. You go, you have this deal that they email you, and you buy into the deal. And if the service is good and the food is good, yeah, you're going to be like, wow, I got this great deal. I got amazing service. I didn't know this place existed.
But I think what you're saying, Truffle, is that you won't get that deal the next time. So what would motivate you to go back to that expensive
and
place?
My answer is like the service. Well, the service and the quality.
Potentially, yeah. And I'm not trying to be cynical for the sake of being cynical. I think that most businesses that are successful inherently have a model that's built on good service, mm-hmm. or built on whatever it is that they're delivering, whether it's a dry cleaner, a restaurant, whatever. They do well because they do those things well to begin with. And, you know, they got to build up word of mouth and advertising and so forth. So Groupon can help with that. But ultimately, what happens down the road is my question, because we're still pretty early in the process of discovering how deep and how long tail this actually is. And, you know, I don't know what the answer is. I'm just saying I'm curious to find out, because I don't really know that if you do an offer like that, and you treat your customers well, and there's good service and good packaging and product and so forth, how many people are really going to return? Because let's face it, we have our routines. We're all limited on time. We have our Chinese place
that we go
to. But
I don't really see what they have to lose. Like, what does the company that's...
I'm not saying they have anything to lose.
They just sold 500 dinners. Half of those people may never even remember to go back.
That's what I mean.
They may never even use their Groupon that they bought.
Potentially, yeah.
So it's this just influx of money, lots of exposure. You create this heat momentum.
There's a finite amount of businesses, and there's a finite amount of businesses.
Oh, I see.
That
you're saying how does something
that.
Like Groupon sustain itself on a local level?
Yeah. What's going to happen in a year and a half, two years? Let's see what happens. I don't know. To your point, I do believe, and with the amount of coverage they're getting right now, the amount of jobs they've created, that's a very positive thing. Mm-hmm. You know, they're hiring writers left and right to write for Groupon.
Right.
Which is, you know, there's never going to be enough jobs for all the writers who are unemployed out there. So
until they shut the internet down.
Of course.
There's another one of them that's actually just, I just want to point out quickly before we get off this subject, called Deals That Matter. And what they do is the same thing as Groupon, but they actually donate 50% of their revenue that they would participate in, right? So the company itself, like Groupon, for example, gets a cut of the deal that they sell. So the restaurant ends up getting, I don't know, 25%, and then Groupon gets 25% of what would have originally been the full price of an entree. Deals That Matter will donate their percentage as a nonprofit to your charity of your choice. So there's an added incentive that you're not only getting a 50% off your pasta dinner, but also helping to cure cancer or whatever, you're creating awareness. So that's kind of another interesting thing where you're kind of inducing altruism by virtue of this, which I think is great. I can't really see anything wrong with that model. I think that's pretty
like
interesting
deals.
Development.
Anything that's 50%.
It's not
off,
something that would have been created right at the outset of the internet. You know what I mean? It took this long and these many iterations, social media and all of that kind of stuff, to sort of figure out this kind of complex model, which may not seem that complex to us now, but I think it's kind of fascinating.
A curiosity that I thought of, and this actually came up in a conversation not too long ago, when we were kids in the 80s growing up, and we'd see Sally Struthers on TV talking about those kids in Africa. what happened to those kids? I mean, what happened to the relationships on this side of the pond? And I'm not saying it to be sarcastic or funny or make light, but I'd be curious to know how many people kept up those relationships, how many people stayed in touch.
What happened to those kids?
Did any of them come over here and go to Stanford and they're curing cancer now? That's really something that you touched on by bringing up the topic separately, but I'm wondering if there's any information out there about that.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Someone should do an expose.
Maybe on episode 23.
Well, another thing that's happened in the last year since we were doing this that sort of plays to all this is much more organized crowdsourced funding. So you have sites like Kickstarter now,
right?
And there's one called 8-Bit Funding. And now we're starting to see all of these sites where you create a project, you've got 30 days to raise $5,000, $10,000, $50,000 to finance your proposed project. And then people can buy in, they pay $5, $10, $50. If you buy $100 in, you get a credit. If you have $500, you get to be an extra. You know, $5, you get a signed DVD or whatever. And it's working. It's
awesome.
I know this
kid that's in... maybe 2 weeks, he raised $5,000 for his EP.
Yeah.
So, like, his fans are funding his...
It's outstanding.
And it's promoting really cool art installation projects and the greening of certain neighborhoods. And I think it's fantastic. These are the sort of things that with the government subsidies dropping off like flies, you know, go to the people and the people are going to do it. There's this real delineation now between the government and the people. Like, it's just the people are just doing it for themselves all across the board. And it's kind of like, how much can you do without somehow the government intervening and shutting you down? That's really what the relationship has become. So that's something I saw kind of concretize itself more in the last year.
Well, it's interesting to look at what's going on with those types of business prospects, whether they're for charity or kind of... you know, obtaining VC on the everyman level, as it were, to what happened in the entertainment industry over the last decade. Meaning as technology, to go back there, became more advanced and cheaper and easier to use, suddenly the big money and big business mechanism that was required to make a record or make a movie 10 or 15 years ago went out the window. And you can do that in your bedroom now. And so the last frontier has become... if you wanted to start a business, once upon a time, you would have to go to the bank and apply for a loan, and you had to have a business plan, or you'd have to find investors. And it was very much this kind of categorized niche where you had to know the right kind of people and business-minded people who either were Horatio Alger up by the bootstraps entrepreneurs, or they went to business school or whatever. But now, as we've just discussed... again, with our good friend the internet and home technology, you can start your own business.
Well, even the distribution model is using torrents. People are actually using the torrents to distribute their films and their records beyond any other method. They're seeding them, their albums and their films themselves, and praying that they get caught up in the so-called piracy wave and that, you know, people will just download their stuff. And that's how they're getting exposure. So, again, it's the people just sort of doing it for themselves. This year, we saw the HDSLR, which is the DSLR cameras, the Canon 7D, the Canon 5D, which by, you know, the last time we were doing one of these podcasts, were just emerging and were just a kind of like, people weren't too sure. However... As of the time of me recording this podcast, Sundance this year, we saw a film called Like Crazy that was shot on a Canon 7D SLR camera sell for $4 million to Paramount. And I think the Grand Jury Prize documentary was shot on a Canon 5D. So that's pretty extraordinary.
Yeah, lots of films are being filmed with a 7D now.
Didn't you make a film? You worked on a film this year.
Yeah, Laid to Rest 2 was shot. I think they used like two or three different 7Ds. And
they were they modified or were they like right out of the box kind of?
I don't think they were modified. They did have a you know, different lenses and yeah. things like that. But it was like a regular production only with 7Ds.
Yeah. I think just a year ago, I was talking about my Canon HV20 HD camcorder as this groundbreaking thing. And I think it's collected more dust now than anything else in the house because yeah. I've been shooting everything on my camera, on my 7D.
I asked you about that yesterday.
Yeah. Can I borrow your HV20?
I've got two words for you, eBay.
Yeah, right. Well, there's one thing I will say, though, about the HV20 that occurred to me. Even though it does now comparatively look like crap, I love the idea of shooting on little mini tapes, mini DV tapes. There's something about being able to go back and discover a tape rather than have these terabyte drives of files that I have no idea what they are, that I'll never convert. And so now it's all about massive media management. It's all about hard drives and, like, you know, it's a completely different thing. Like, I spend more time going through old raw data images that I shot than I do taking pictures. Like, I haven't taken a picture in 2 months because I've got so many pictures on my 8-frame-per-second raw image shooting camera to go through, let alone the hard drive space to store it. So the entire workflow process is different, and the way that my mind works about it is different. So there's something to be said about those tapes. In fact, when we were watching Exit Through the Gift Shop, mm-hmm. the Banksy documentary, which mm-hmm. is amazingly enough nominated for an Oscar.
Yeah.
You know, it's all about this Thierry guy who's just shot everything around him. Everything from his feet on the ground to the toilet flushing to these street artists. And he had thousands and thousands of these mini DV tapes, one point he could just hand off to Banksy.
Well, but the kind of point of that is when it came time, when that footage actually became valuable and it came time for him to use it, and he was essentially commissioned to take all of that great footage, those unique moments, and create a documentary. He couldn't do it.
Yeah.
And he
yeah.
was just going through the boxes of stuff he had and taking, oh, here's something from March, here's something from April, here's something from last year, which I think it's going to be increasingly commonplace for all of us. And we're just going to have this pollution, you know, gigabytes and gigabytes, if not terabytes upon terabytes of MP3s and WAVs and JPEGs and PDFs.
Maybe, because I went back to my parents' house and I gave someone a couple of old 8mm videotapes that I found in the garage, you know, under a brick near a pile of cat piss to bring back. Now, the odds of me finding a video file, an AVI file, on some dead drive from 10, 15 years ago are nil. I just don't have those files anymore. They've either been overwritten or the drive crashed or I never bothered to copy it over, right? The amount of data that I would have created digitally in the last 15 years is most definitely not on the 15 drives I have under my desk right now. It just kind of goes away. But I found these tapes. Tapes when I was 14 years old walking around Brighton Beach with my dad, you know, or in Ecuador with my family when I was 12. So there's something that's going away here, and it's very interesting to me what this new digital thing. I think more elegant solutions. Of course, now we're moving into the cloud. So now it's all becoming about cloud storage and cloud computing. For anybody who still doesn't know what cloud computing or storage is, it means it's not on a local hard drive. It means you've uploaded it to some company like Amazon or Google from whom you rent massive storage space. They have huge, like Picasa or Flickr, or something like that, where they store your stuff for you online. So of course, that again raises the paranoia of, well, now somebody else has all of your data for you, and if they go out of business or they decide to shut you down or you don't have access, you really don't have access to it anymore.
Right.
But it's a solution to having, you know, 50 drives at home, which you kick
around.
Well,
that was, I mean, the stuff that's physical, the box of actual snapshots, the 3x5 pictures that were shot on film, the old 8mm videotapes, and, you know, going back generations, home movies on 16mm and 8mm film, you know, theater film. Those things are going to stand the test of time in a way that digital media won't, if only because digital media is so grossly easy to produce in large quantities. Meaning, you used to maybe go on vacation, you'd have a roll or two of 24 pics, you'd maybe shoot them all, you'd have 48 pics and six of them were good and the rest went in the garbage and whatever, that's what you had. Now you go on vacation, you shoot 137 pictures every day, you come home, you put it all on your hard drive, you're not going to go and look through seven times 137 pictures. You'll maybe go, okay, well, there's that one really cute picture we took of each other the last night at the luau, whatever, I'll send that, I'll put that on Facebook. And the rest of the stuff just becomes pollution.
So you're talking about the selectivity that is...
Well, we become hoarders, I think.
We become digital hoarders, yeah.
You don't... Well, what if that picture is important to me in 5 years and I want to look at it? Whereas before you would take 12 pictures. They're all important. They go in a shoebox. But you were very specific about, you know, what you took pictures of and how many you would take in a day. Now you're just like...
And you always knew where that shoebox was.
Yeah.
If the house was going to burn down, that was maybe one of the things you'd go after.
Yeah.
We all have probably one or two or three different... You know, everybody has their computer hard drive on their machine, and then everybody has one or two external hard drives and probably a couple thumb drives, and then you've got your memory card that's in your camera, and then you've got your memory card that's in your phone with your camera phone, and you don't know where anything is.
You should see me walking around in an airport with a Kindle, an iPod, a BlackBerry, a netbook. I mean, it's, oh yeah, my point-and-shoot camera, my 7D camera. I'm like, Jesus, what am I supposed to do with all this shit? I've got like 19 devices now. I really want to build some kind of like Velcro suit where I can just Velcro everything to myself and walk around and then still like make it look cool, because I think that's the only way I can handle it anymore.
So do you think, to throw this to you guys, because it sounds like we all kind of agree on what's happening with our ease of use and access to having so much media and kind of the improbability of going through all of it, is it really all about who the best editors are now? And I don't mean editor on a grand Hollywood scale. I just mean
the editors don't even have time, because the editors are so inundated.
Well, that's kind of my point.
Nobody's going to have the time to go back through your life and edit through all of your stuff, because they're covered in it themselves. So unless you're paying a premium.
I mean you as an editor, who the best editors are, meaning the people who take the time.
Oh, who I do. Discretion.
Discretion, exactly. Is it going to be less about who the best photographer is in a empirical sense of what a good picture is, what the best film is, what the best blog update is, or is it really going to be about who is just being more concise and more articulate and more self-editing to make their statement?
Well, we've certainly spoken about tastemakers on this show. Right. We've talked about the era of the tastemaker and the person who's going to be there essentially to provide the role of curator to you. Mm-hmm. To say, I will tell you what the best record out of 100,000 records was this year. I will tell you. And in a way, that's what we do when we make these podcasts, and that's what we do when we write blogs and when we tweet, is we're kind of slicing through it all and kind of getting to the point. And then you decide, you know, and then of course we aggregate the aggregators. So then you have a person that you follow because they've got a list of the top five people who have the best taste, who can pick through all of this, and then you boil it down. But I think you're right. What brings to mind for me is thinking of the stories of the old country that my grandma would tell me. You know, I remember that one Christmas we had one plum and one Turkish dessert, and we all shared it and we just appreciated it so much. And you think, like, yeah, you probably really did love that plum that you got that week. You know, now you just go out and you buy too much of everything and half it goes in the trash and you don't really think about it, and you're watching TV while you're eating it and you're doing something else and you don't really think about
it. Two of them have rotted. You just throw them out.
I mean, I could get dragon fruit in the middle of winter. It's just insane to me. I've seen countless articles this year about how many billions of pounds of food are wasted just by virtue of the travel, you know, like what the ratio is of the food that's actually collected versus what arrives and is sold and is consumed. And it's absolutely atrocious, the amount of waste that goes on for just this knowing that we have this abundance. It's not even that you're going to eat the dragon fruit when you go into Whole Foods in the dead of winter. You just want to know that it's there, because you'd be really, really concerned and get anxious if you went into the Whole Foods and all there was squash. Do you know what I'm saying? You'd be like, wait a minute, what's going on? Is there like a pandemic or is this the nuclear fallout? Like, where is the dragon fruit? So there's this feeling that we need to have everything available to us at all times to sort of appease our anxiety, you know, make us feel like everything's good.
Do you think that's just an American thing?
I'm talking about when I was in Canada. I mean, I'm talking about, it's just a mindset. But sure, it's the developed countries. We have this assumption that all things will always be available to us. And then we want more. Because the process is, okay, good, I've got Pro Tools 7. But now I want Pro Tools 8. Now I want 8.01. So 7 can't be any good anymore, you know? I got to get a 9, and I've got to get the latest iPad and the latest and look at the cult of Mac. I mean, it's like I need the new Macintosh, and then I need the new one, and I got to get rid of the old one. Why is it so? What's the processing that's changing so much here? I mean, most indie games that we played this year were all like 8-bit throwbacks. They had graphics that were far less complex than stuff that was going on 5 years ago, and yet my computer had to be faster and stronger to do it all for some reason. Anyway.
Well, I think what you've touched upon there is the principles behind consumerism, which are basically, to go back to what Amy was saying a little bit ago when we were talking about Groupon, reflect upon the end experience. So who cares if a game is 8-bit, 32-bit, if it's 64-bit computing at its high end, as long as the gameplay is fun and the game is rewarding? Who cares if Dragon Fruit is incredibly expensive, more so than whatever should be in season locally, provided that you can get it and you love your dragon fruit and so on. And it, with Mac, you bring up a really good point. You know, there are people who just have to have whatever the latest Mac thing is, and there's nothing wrong with the Mac thing that they had before. Actually, to take a step back even further, if you want to look at the credit problem that we've had in North America and in Europe, really that kind of is indicative of what drives that mass consumerism. If you really had to think before you spent money, if you had to go down to the bank on Saturday morning like our parents had to and get money out for the week.
And stand in line for 45 minutes.
Stand in line and think about, okay, you know, we have to get groceries, but also the gas bill has to be paid and the mortgage payment. And you took out that much money and you couldn't just throw it all on a credit card and worry about it later. Do you feel like we'd be in the mess that we're in right now?
Or do a microtransaction from your cell phone?
Yeah, do a microtransaction for yourself.
One-click checkout.
You know, Iceland, the huge problem Iceland's had with their bankruptcy is all because of credit. You know, everyone overextended themselves on credit, and they're a freaking island in the middle of North Atlantic where they have to import everything, and so everything's twice as expensive as it needs to be, and everyone just charged away for years and years, and now it caught up to them. When you look at that on kind of the grand scheme, and then you take it back into your household, we all kind of do a little bit of Iceland every single day. When you go to Whole Foods, you buy a bunch of groceries. You're not going to eat them all. You're not going to eat all that fruit and stuff. Like Amy said, you just wind up throwing it out. It's rotten. I'll just throw it out, and then I'll go back out and get some more. And we have in North America, more so than in Europe, and certainly more so than in Asia and in South America, where things are more family-oriented, we have this sickness where we live in ones and twos quite a bit. We have our own apartments, or maybe we have a roommate or a boyfriend, girlfriend, husband, wife, whatever. And we buy so much more than we need for one or two people.
True, just, right? Because in Ecuador, you sort of do the family meal and the family everything. Yeah. And why don't we talk for a sec? Didn't you go to South America recently, Truffle?
I did. I've been to South America a number of times now.
But you had quite an adventure there recently.
Yeah, I had a lot of adventures.
Let's touch on a couple of your highlights just really quickly.
I'd have to say an amazing thing, which I only experienced due to the advice that I received from yourself and other people, was spending time in Ecuador, not just in Quito, which is the capital, which is kind of the given, or maybe the Galapagos would be the given, which I didn't go to, but going to Otavalo, which is this small village, and I don't mean small village like there's 12 people in a hut. It's a reasonably sized town, but small by comparison. And the whole town kind of focuses on the central market that happens on the weekend, and it just goes off. And I've traveled all over the world. I've been fortunate to do that. But I've never seen every city has its market, and it's really the same everywhere. You know, it's trinkets. And
right.
You think you're looking at something in Ecuador that's special, and you're like, wait a second, I saw this exact same thing in Thailand.
Right.
You know? someone in China is making these ashtrays and sending them out. But it was the kind of one of the only times, other than maybe being in Africa, where I experienced people at market actually selling, local people selling chickens and pigs for actual personal use, or vegetables for actual personal use. And it was very helpful for me to stand there and kind of be in the middle of all this chaos and appreciate, this is what it was like 100 years ago. This is what it was like 200 years ago.
Because the majority of the people buying there are not, they're not tourists. Actually, most of the people that are going into Alto Valle to buy things are actually indigenous peoples.
Yeah.
Right.
You were there, Amy. I think we talked about that on one of the podcasts. It's like an extraordinary place. And very, I mean, it's kind of the antithesis of this other paradigm that we're talking about here with the Whole Foods and the mass produce and dragon fruit wherever you go.
I'll tell you a great story that I think can kind of help epitomize what we're talking about, the contrast between these two experiences, our kind of Western consumer-based experience and kind of debt-based experience, and then the need-based experience that we witnessed in Ecuador. When I was in Africa, I met some people, and they were all kind of well-to-do. They were upper class, and one of them had gone away to school and came back, and he was a very successful white-collar businessman. And one night we got to talking about his school and kind of where he was from. And this is in Tanzania, by the way. And he said the only reason he had to go to school was because there was a government mandate where one child from every family had to go to school, because the president in his wisdom saw that the future was we need to get education instilled in our families. And his family didn't like him. He was the least liked in his family. I don't know if it was because he was lazy or he smelled funny or what it was, but basically his father, the head of household, and the other men in the family sat around and they said, we have our chickens, we have our goats, we've got our hut, we've got our outhouse. The market's just down the way. What's school? What is school? That's not going to help us plant things or right. bring the animals to slaughter or to market. And so they sent him to school because it seemed like the superfluous, completely unnecessary thing. And they didn't like him. And so, you know, he went away to school and he makes more in a day than they make in a year now. And of course, you know, he goes back and he contributes to his family that way. But that type of experience is kind of indicative of the opposite of what we do every day here in the Western world, where we wake up and maybe we go to work and then we spend money on whatever, versus really having to think about what's important. And not only think about what's important, but thinking about...
But are we worse off because of the fact that we don't even have to think about or worry about those things?
Well, that's my point. The folks that I'm talking about, his family, were so ultra-focused on what was necessary that they couldn't see into the future and understand how they could be helped other than what was happening now. It's just kind of the contrast between the two experiences. When you look at either of them, neither seems to be right, but both are true.
Well, I guess what I'm saying is it's not, you know, I'm not complaining about all of the incredible things that we have at our disposal. I mean, don't get me wrong here. I'm not being sour about it. I just wish that there was a way that we could sort of moderate it. We do not moderate. We just go absolutely crazy with it. I think of cats when you leave the whole bag of food out and they'll just eat and eat and eat. You know, they don't know how to just stop with one bowl of food. So anyway.
We're just a gluttonous society.
You all right, by the way? Amy, did you go and hack up a lung?
I went and hacked up a lung.
What happened? Have you not tried out the new electronic blue? I know that you don't smoke, but I've got to tell you that I've recently switched from lighting up paper and
you're doing the vapor
weed
smokes now?
To those hip blue electronic cigarettes.
They smell like hookah.
Let me tell you something.
I know a lot of people using them.
It would have been awesome if Johnny Depp hadn't ruined it in that awful crap movie he made, The Tourist.
Are you kidding me?
If that movie had been awesome, then I would feel so much cooler smoking my blue cigarette.
That movie made me want to punch someone right in the face. Like, I don't know why it made
that movie
so
is
angry.
What happens when you are one of those models who knows that you're beautiful to the point of annoyance, and that's all it was. It just finally put right out there on the table what bothers me about both Angie Jolie and Johnny Depp, and has always bothered me about the two of them. They're both talented and they're both gorgeous, but they both know it, and I can't ever see them do anything that isn't somehow linked to that self-consciousness. And that movie totally revealed that to the highest level, and it was such an embarrassing, awful waste of my two hours.
I didn't see the movie, but I knew it wasn't going to be any good based on the release date. So I just kind of
What was the release date gave away?
I think tricky. Yeah, I think most people know that if a movie's good, it comes out, you know, after April, and ideally, unless it's like going to be an Oscar contender, you're not going to see a movie come out in December unless it's Christmas Day.
Speaking of Oscar contenders, let's do 5 seconds on that. Who's going to win the Oscar this year? Is there any question?
I think King's Speech.
King's Speech is going to win it.
Yeah. I think The Fighter will win something.
Is it one of those things where it has to? Let's really talk about that. Maybe we should save this for an Oscars podcast.
Well, let's put it down. As the nominations have come out and as just tonight the is the awards. SAG Awards. So it's already starting to like give it all up, you know? Here's what I should say is we will not remember the other movies, but the one that wins in a few years. Like some of them are just going to fall away, like Winter's Bone. Mm-hmm. Which is terrific. We saw the other day. Must have been made for $1 million. Winter's Bone is spectacular. The Fighter was a great film.
Yes.
Black Swan.
You know what's really interesting about what you just said, and anybody who lives in the LA area should do this sometime. The next time you're over at Hollywood and Highland, which of course we go every day.
Right.
Go and take a moment and go stand at the foot of the Kodak Theater on the concrete red carpet and look at all of the Best Picture winners. Just over the last 10 years in recent memory.
Oh.
And you'll be astonished how many of those movies are completely forgettable today.
Yeah.
And what I'd be interested in, man, I'm really interested in a lot of research right now.
Yeah.
Sally Struthers and Kids in Africa. I'd be really interested in seeing somebody take all of those movies that won Best Picture, let's say for the last 20 years when marketing really became refined, and compare it to the amount of budget that was put behind the movie. Mm-hmm. In terms of getting it made and the amount of budget that was spent marketing the movie and then who actually won versus who the other contenders were. But I tell you, if you stand and you look at those plaques and you see every movie, you're like, wow, that movie sucked. That sucked. Wow, that won Best Picture? Oh my God. It's kind of that experience. Yeah. And then you get back into like the 70s and the 60s, and there's a lot of movies that I don't even know what they are. But you kind of like, okay, yes, I do recall reading somewhere, my father told me, or I saw this late one night. Wow, what an amazing movie. Like, the whole industry is completely
I'll tell you about what an amazing movie is that came out this year that will get absolutely zero acknowledgement in the U.S. Gaspar Noé's Enter the Void, an absolute mind-bending, once-in-a-lifetime masterpiece of the highest order. On par with Blade Runner, which you know I have no equal for. I put it on par with The Stalker by Andrei Tarkovsky. I put it up there with...
I see Amy's chomping at the bit to say something here.
Jump on in.
No.
No, she refused.
I'm telling you, this is
I'm not saying
the
I
more
like
I get
it.
Into filmmaking, and this is I put a lot of time and learning into filmmaking, and I'm just starting to really get my hands dirty with it. The more this film just blew me away, what an accomplishment it was, and his audacity and the brilliance of it. And I'm only talking about it as the way that I am because most people will never even know it existed. You know, it'll go by 2, 3, 4 years, they'll still never know it existed.
Enter the Void, yeah.
I'm just putting down a little footnote here just to point out that I saw it, and I'm telling you what an extraordinary film experience that was.
That's a pretty highly lauded footnote.
Oh,
well, I was watching it.
I don't give them away lately.
I got the opportunity to watch it with Karim, and it's a movie I don't know, it affected me in a different way, not in a bad way, but I literally had to stand up and walk out of the room at one point. Not because it was bad, it was just so much.
Because it was so much.
It was so much for me. I think he got offended a little bit, thinking that I didn't like the movie.
No, I didn't get offended.
So it was the opposite of The Tourist.
It was the antithesis.
Yeah, I wanted to punch someone in the face, but not because the movie was bad.
Let's talk about contrast again. So this is a movie that, from the sound of it, has accomplished on some or maybe many levels what the medium of film potentially can achieve.
Can do uniquely.
It can move you. It can engage you. It can make you uncomfortable to the point where you have to leave the room versus looking at a couple of really attractive mannequins saying...
Walk
through the paces, phone it in.
I don't
want to
pay
$14
for that.
And no one will ever hear of Enter the Void.
Yeah,
the thing about Enter the Void is the same thing that Tarkovsky does. And this is something that I've found actually to be really interesting is time in the last year has been a very interesting character. I bought a Kindle, and the Kindle did the same thing that something like Enter the Void does, or like The Stalker does for me, which is that all of a sudden I have to be engaged in something where nothing else can happen at the same time. It's asking for 100% of my attention, and it's asking for it at long lengths. So... with my Kindle, for example, I'll read and I'll realize, wow, I'm not doing anything else. I'm not popping over to email and Twitter and Facebook. All I can do is just look at this and read. And I love it. And I'll do it for hours. I read far more now than I ever did before I had my Kindle. I can have huge tomes included on it that otherwise I would never have carried around. Besides that, Enter the Void does the same thing. It asks me to sit there for 145 minutes and... doesn't really want to guide me along anywhere. It just wants me to lay back and experience viscerally this dream state that you're going through. And that is an experience that nothing else can give you but cinema.
And the way it's shot kind of makes you feel like you're looking, it's happening
first
to you.
First person.
Yeah.
It's like a first-person shooter video game where at the beginning of the film, you literally see the hands in front of you to the degree where the screen keeps going to black and you realize that the director has even emulated the character blinking. So every time he would blink, the screen is blinking and it's really bothersome at first. And the sound of his voice talking is that kind of muted sound of your own voice that you hear inside your own head, which... it's him talking to not only the immersion within the story that he's telling, but he's also talking to this generation. I mean, a lot of our stories now are coming to us from video games, a $50 billion a year industry. And, you know, we're BioShock 2 and Fallout Vegas and all of these games that we're playing in the first person where you're in these giant sandbox worlds and you're living this stuff in stories that are way, way longer than cinema. These are 50-hour arcs, these storylines that you're playing. So he's playing to that in this film, add to which he's dealing with the Tibetan Book of the Dead and reconciliation. It's just absolutely amazing. So the film captured for me something that really had to do with the zeitgeist, you know, like the real front-edge kind of cultural spirit of the times. That's why I loved it so much.
And you saw this film on Netflix streaming, correct?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So let's talk about Netflix streaming for a second.
All right.
Which is completely nerfed up in Canada by Rogers, by the way.
Rogers is a monopoly.
They have a totally different catalog in Canada. They just launched Netflix in Canada this year.
And finally. Don't they have to pay a lot more than we have to
pay? I don't know if they have to pay a lot more, but I can just tell you it's the weak sauce version of what we've had in the States for like 4 years now.
But my argument would be it gives people the opportunity to actually see things that they absolutely would never watch otherwise.
Yep, I totally agree.
Given the choice, Enter the Void might be something that people wind up watching because they don't have a plethora of the tourist and whatever.
Totally,
the
I'm
top
totally with you. I absolutely
are.
Love Netflix streaming. Yeah. In fact, I should answer this question. We have another viewer question. And someone said, "I'm up in Canada. I have Netflix. You know, what are some documentaries you'd recommend seeing on there?" I don't know what you guys have, and the point that you just made, Truffle, is a great point because it's totally about the long tail films and being exposed to those things. My top 500 queue that I have on Netflix is just the most amazing series of films. It's Kurosawa and it's Fellini and it's Bergman and it's all this stuff that I would otherwise not watch, but because I get to curate it and watch it in this cool streaming function with my Xbox controller, it's a lot more fun. And I just kind of go through these marathon nights.
Yeah,
I would not have gone out to Blockbuster and rented 5 Bergman films.
Exactly.
And, like, whatever.
Exactly.
I've never had an issue with the selection of instance.
Talking about the documentaries, to answer someone's point, was were there any great documentaries you remember seeing this year? I mean, off the top of your head?
I saw, this was a year of documentaries for me. And maybe
lucky.
we'll do another one of these closer to Academy Awards time. But the reason I brought up that point about Netflix and being afforded the opportunity to watch things you might not normally watch, even if it's out of boredom, is I saw two great documentaries. One is called Tapped. It's about the bottled water industry.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely everybody breathing in North America should watch this documentary. And it's very short. It's about 70 or 75 minutes long. And if you're not moved to anger and if you don't change your consuming habits after watching this film, then shame on you. I wouldn't have watched it had it not been on Netflix streaming. And another one that's out there, which got a lot of critical acclaim at the end of last year, and then I think kind of got swept under the rug, is a war documentary called Restrepo, which is about U.S. Armed Forces in Afghanistan.
It's got an Oscar nom.
And it just is something. Is that right? See, yeah. I've been out of the country, so I don't even
know. No, but yeah.
Out of the loop.
It's completely immersive. There's very little setup. There's no Sean Penn narrating or anything like that. You're just thrown into the experience to try and kind of get a sense of what it must be, not just for U.S. troops, but for troops anywhere in the world playing this dangerous game of war. Not that they're playing the game, but as our governments continue to war and countries war and religions war, what that means in 2010 and 2011 versus what it meant in 1943.
Right.
Yeah. And it's completely
mind-blowing. The suicide rate is extremely high now, too.
It's ridiculous.
With the soldiers that are abroad.
Again, everybody should watch it just to be informed.
Yeah.
You don't have to love war or not like war or whatever. You should just watch it so you know what the experience is like.
Two excellent choices. Do you have any, Amy, that you can think of off the top of your head?
I don't know if we might have mentioned them all. Exit through the gift shop. I think it was Oscar worthy? Maybe not.
Yep. I want to add one that is not yet on Netflix streaming. It's called Over Your City's Grass Will Grow. And it's a documentary about Anselm Kiefer, who's a fine artist who does huge, huge pieces. And what he did is he went to the south of France and he wanted to figure out the right way to frame one of his paintings. So he got this small bulldozer and he dug out some earth from below so that you could walk up a ramp towards the painting. And then he realized that it would be even cooler if he could build tunnels under the ground that would lead up to a set of stairs that would lead up to the painting. And then he started pouring concrete molds into these giant blocks and building huge post-apocalyptic industrial towers that look like they might have been there for 500 years, and just laying these stacks of concrete blocks, bricks on top of each other in these edifices that you can't really enter or exit. And he's essentially built an entire village of houses and underground tunnels and warehouses and things that have no other function except to frame one painting, all on his own. The score is by, like, Giorgi Ligeti. It's an absolute masterpiece. Like, Sophie Fiennes, who directed it, gives you access through these buildings by virtue of cranes and so on that you would not be able to have if you were there on foot, if you could ever find this place on foot. So that was a highlight for me. I saw it at TIFF. And another one will be, there's a documentary about the Magnetic Fields, the enigmatic, awesome, awesome band, the Magnetic Fields, whose record 69 Love Songs is among my top 10 ever.
One of the best.
It's about Steve Merritt, you know, the composer. And again, nobody's really ever known anything about the Magnetic Fields, and people who love them more than anything. They're kind of like they might be giants, like it's your band, it's the one thing, but everybody else doesn't know about them. So it was great. It was called Strange Powers, and I saw it at the Vancouver Film Festival. And if you ever get a chance to see Strange Powers about Steve Merritt of the Magnetic Fields, I highly recommend it. He's incredibly wry, intelligent. It's a funny, smart, totally inspiring documentary about what happens when you go it alone for years and years without widespread recognition. And eventually, the accolades and the respect come back to you for doing things your own way. Just like Richard Thompson, who's now being knighted. You know, who knows who Richard Thompson is? But the people who do know that this is a quiet genius who's been making music for, what, 40 years now?
Forever and a day.
Yeah.
And what's sad is when I look at my record collection, and I have probably 6 records of his, it's such a chunk if you have records on a shelf or whatever, it's such a chunk compared to, you know, something like Interpol or The National, which is 3 or 4 records or whatever. And you kind of, even knowing who he is, you kind of look at him and you're like, who is this guy?
What? We don't know anything about him.
Yeah, it's just a strange. That's crazy. He's being knighted.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the queen is going to knight Richard Thompson.
As well she should.
So hot.
I want to just say one thing here.
Is being a knight, is that a hot?
Totally.
So in the United States, we don't have an equivalent, do we?
The United States?
Oh.
Anyway.
We don't have, like, if the United States had a knight thing and you met a guy and he was like,
the French have that order of something or other. You join the order of something.
Okay.
That they give away to everybody.
Something like that.
If you're American, not even American, if you're not a British citizen, you can still receive an award from
apparently. United Kingdom. Sean Connery, for example.
But you're cut off at a certain point. You can only go so high.
Oh, speaking of Sean Connery, I had a really good time shooting a film called Ecstasy, which I had to learn a complete Scottish accent for.
And we'll hear a little bit of it.
don't put me on the spot like that.
All right,
I'm not sure I can do it, but really it was a good time. We were up in the Sault Ste. Marie and we shot for like 3 weeks on the red camera. And it was really good. I got to work with Billy Boyd and Adam Sinclair, and it took them 10 years to put it together, but we hope it's going to be great. It's like a follow-up to Trainspotting. Anyway, so...
I've just one question for you, Trebek. Do they make that sweater for a man?
Precisely, which is far better than what I just attempted.
Ridiculously not true.
Okay, another question. If you didn't have hands, what would you have for hands?
Yeah, if you could have anything for hands except for hands, what would you have?
My answer to this is octopi. I would like to have an octopus on each hand. So I could, instead of having five, I would have eight, and they'd have suction cups on them, tentacles. Oh. What would you have instead, Truffle?
I need to think about that for a second.
He doesn't even dare
Amy?
Ask me.
Come on.
I would have one that's a penis with a suction cup on the end.
I'm not going to be able to sleep. And what would the other one be?
A glitter shooter. It would spray glitter everywhere.
All right. Sounds like that would be useful in the workplace.
Yes.
I would have a on one on each limb. I'd have a Craftsman Leatherman tool. It's kind of like a Swiss Army knife type of thing.
Oh, yeah, I changed mine to that.
You might want to.
You changed yours from a penis with a tentacle on the end?
No. Yeah. No, she changed the other one.
Oh, no.
The glitter shooter. No, the glitter shooter stays no matter what.
Yeah, no matter what.
That's non-negotiable.
And I think the other one I'd have to have an iPhone.
Oh, really?
A permanent, like, can I just ask you two something? How would you make pasta and stuff? How would you make...
I didn't think about that.
I could with the Leatherman, you know. It's no problem.
I have really flexible
feet. What would you do when you were at the TSA and you have to like get your fingerprints done and you put your penis with a tentacle or your iPhone down? They're like, no, could I really? Like, I guess the octopus thing is not going to help either.
Well, I mean, if people have different things for hands, I guess.
I'm just saying, if I was getting attacked like in the Wild West, like I was in like, you know, running the plains of Arizona and all of a sudden something came at me, I'd rather have two octopus stuck to the ends of my hands than an iPhone and a glitter shooter. I'm just saying.
Well, think about it.
Well, I would
if someone's chasing you and all of a sudden this big, huge blast of like rainbow glitter like shoots in your face all fine and everything, you're going to go blind.
And then I could stab lots of people with my Leatherman, and then I could use my iPhone GPS to call for help. And
I think my hands would just freak people out.
You know? Can you explain the penis with a tentacle?
How are you going to comb your
hair? No, a suction cup.
How are you going to comb your hair with octopi?
Yeah.
Very easily. You know how intelligent octopi are? I would be quadrupling my intelligence level on top of the fact that I would have prehensile multiple... Never mind. It would be great. I could draw lots of...
What?
I could color a picture with all the different crayons at the same time.
When you put it like that, I think I maybe misunderstood the question. If you're going to put it in those terms,
yeah,
then I'd rather have a chimpanzee...
Right,
for one hand.
I'd have Betty White as one.
You'd have Betty White as one of your hands.
Yeah.
I would like the left hand of Jimmy Page.
And Abe Vigoda on the other one.
Do you want to answer any more questions?
What's the other question that we have?
Let's see. What is the airspeed velocity of a swallow?
If we're going to get into the money.
No, we're not. We're
no,
not
that's
kidding.
Dumb.
We're not even going to go.
Have you heard of this thing called the iPod?
Yeah.
And I think one of the final questions is from Eric Costello of Toronto, Canada.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
He writes, why does it hurt when I pee? Okay. Eric.
Do you want to take that one?
I'll take it.
That's we've gone from Monty Python to Zappa.
Yeah.
Like that.
Strangely enough, they're both from him. Eric, I think you have something called chlamydia, and you should probably see a doctor.
So I want to thank everyone. Oh,
he's just mad
Truffle, next time
it.
You and I will be publishing something out to the world, we're going to be doing a new series on Music Zeitgeist about albums you will not find on iTunes.
We're going to do a couple different new series, but that's one of them. Yeah,
yeah, I'm really excited about that one.
The problem with, just briefly, the problem with iTunes, the problem with the internet is that everybody has forgotten how to collect records other than what's made available to them online.
Yeah.
And so there's great records from 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, but even 90s. The 80s and 90s when records were plentiful and CD manufacturing became super cheap and anyone could make a record. There's a lot of that stuff that's simply not available online.
The bands have disbanded, the members are dead, the whatever.
The record labels went belly up.
No one digitized it.
The master tapes were lost, whatever, no one digitized it. And if you're only looking at iTunes or your whatever it is, Music Match or whatever
you're
using.
Even the torrents.
Even the torrents don't have a lot of this stuff. You are missing out. So that's what we're going to be working on in 2011.
Yeah, awesome. MusicZeitgeist.com. Make sure to check it out for these amazing new series we're going to be launching this year. I'm really excited to be talking to my savvy music friends and discovering new records that have just gone missing. And also, we will be posting thoughts about films this year, documentaries, the Oscars, and all of it over at theculturepin.com. Thank you, Amy Lynn Chadwick, for joining us.
Of course.
On our 20th episode. And thank you, Truffle Jones.
I'd shake both your hands, but you have suction cups.
Right?
Attached.
It would taste...
It's always a pleasure.
You have a penis envy.
I hope we can come back and talk Oscar in a couple weeks.
Yeah, I'd love to have you back. And thank you to all of the listeners. You can hear this podcast and all others at caromcast.com. And feel free to email us, info@caromcast.com. And also, you can follow me on Twitter at Constant Change, and you can follow Amy on Twitter at Amy. That's AIMEEL Chadwick.
CHADWICK at Twitter.com.
And get all of her kooky tweets.
And if you want to follow me, you got to do it in an unmarked van.
That's right.
Ooh, snap.
Thanks for listening.